Confusion matrix.
There's a fundamental problem with basic sales and marketing here, in that it sort of doesn't matter whether it would work in some way, in some part of your business, if what you're saying on the outset, that A, you don't know where it's going to work, and B, you don't know if it's going to work, right? I mean, you might as well just literally be selling snake oil. There's no difference from an outside-in perspective, which is why so many of these conversations with people who don't know about this stuff end the same way, because it absolutely bloody should end that way, right? I'm not saying that people shouldn't use these. I'm saying that they are being psychologically astute by walking away from them. And that's the problem that the entire industry has.
Right, and we're rolling. Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm fantabulous. I am fed with German meatballs after a lot of physical exertion, and so feeling both quite pleased with myself for all the exercise and sort of slightly guilty that I then ate a bunch of fatty pork products. I mean, these things happen, right?
Exactly. Well, it's all about balance. So get the exercise, get the calories, right?
Indeed.
Excellent. So, let's jump into what we're going to talk about today, which is, I think, a bit of a follow-on from previous episodes. Last time round, we were talking about personalized software, which kind of is gone adjacent to what we want to talk about today, which is, are the models plateauing? If there's such a word as plateauing, I'm not sure if it's a verb. Another way of putting that is, if the models are as good as they get, where do we go from here? I'll just give it a little bit of context. I mean, I was chatting to a friend of mine who's not very close to this sort of stuff, but in the tech field, I was just chatting to if he used AI, which he didn't much. He said, I've tried it a few times. It just did things I didn't want. I had some hallucinations, the usual sort of feedback for a one-off use. And they said, but I'm sure they'll iron all of that out, and then it'll be great after that, and then there'll be, a lot of changes. And I just had that sort of pause in my head. I said, that they might not get a lot better, especially the idea that the hallucinations will disappear. And part of everything else, as we discussed many times, is that these models are probabilistic, and they are not working off a deterministic, here's a question, this is a definitive answer, there is no other answer, and that's programmed in, and I'm just fetching that single answer. They are going to data with thousands or millions of points of reference, and then pulling out something which is commonly used out there in all of this data, and that's the answer it gives, which most of the time is good and sufficient for people's uses. But with the current architecture, there's a big question there of, well, will that ever change? If they're always going to be probabilistic, are they always going to hallucinate? So we could probably talk a little bit about the technical side of it, but really, I'm personally thinking more about the ramifications of these things will get a bit better, but not much better. So what are your sort of initial thoughts on that?
I think there's an element of, yes, of course, they're going to get better, but how far down the route of diminishing returns are we? And I would suggest further than many people would like you to believe. I think there is the question of, firstly, what is better and better than what, right? If what we're talking about here is general purpose language models, then does it matter if they've plateaued when actually a lot of the gains that we might see in the coming years will be around much more specialized models? And so there is, what does better mean, right? And is it really valid and useful and efficient to be running these gigantic models that both know the history of some 16th century philosopher and the chemical structure of dexamphetamine. You know what I mean? It's like, I think there's a question around the validity and the longevity of general purpose models. I think in my mind, that's probably the overarching question. But yeah. I think we probably should poke around the edges of what these models actually are and what we mean by better.
Yeah, better being better than they are now with masses of hallucinations and getting it wrong all the time. These weird behaviours, I was running some stuff the other day. Well, and again, we're into a little bit of the testing side. So I ran the same thing twice, and partly because I was trying to get a wrong answer, right? So, and I was doing some quite specific questioning around company finances and figures and getting it to call them out. And our model was doing a very good job. It's one of the reasoning ones. And so it was going off, finding the numbers, coming back, saying, oh, I think the numbers mean this, so therefore I have to calculate this. And so here's the, average growth over the 3 years for net income for this company. Oh, yeah, it's pretty good. It's done really good there. So let me ask it if it can do that company compared with a different company. So one half of that question was exactly the same, as in the same company, get the same figures, calculate the same figure, but just get another company and compare that. And went off and did that and then just made up all the numbers. So I'm like, okay, so you've just run and given me 100% correct answer. And then I run you a second time with, the same question with a little addendum to now do a comparison with another company. So you've got to do the same again with another company, with no history. So it didn't know that it had done this already because it's a clear chat history. And just adding in that extra comparison and that extra bit of work meant that the whole thing failed. That's a real head scratcher. And it leads into all the things we've talked about in the past. So now you're into, well, do I try and go back to what I had before? Do I forward fix this? Do I ignore it? And so you suddenly got that decision. And plus the sudden trust issue of, well, that one it did for me yesterday, well, was that completely correct? So will elements like that, I'm sure elements like that will get better, but will they ever be eliminated? And as we talked about in our test episode, we've got to move away from the mindset of, well, if I give it A, the answer is B and it's always B and that will never change and that's it. And so therefore I can test against B. We know these things aren't like that. So we can't test it for B. But of course, on the other hand, this isn't just a test. This is actually a piece of work I want it to do. Effectively, it's getting it wrong. So in terms of providing a system which says it does this work for you, the answer is, well, actually, as we talked about before, it's more like an intern that's doing some work for you, and caveat at the bottom, intern may get this wrong as well as right.
Yeah, I mean, it's less of a question of, can I do this? It's, can I do this consistently, and can I plan my workload around achieving this task using this approach, right? And that last one for me is particularly problematic because people aren't great at estimating how long it's going to take to do things. But in general, most of the people out there in middle management are doing sort of slightly more predictable work, are pretty decent at knowing how long it's going to take to do things, excepting for, issues that arise. And so can give pretty reliable answers. And you can say, I mean, look, if I want this person to do this task, they're going to get it done, right? Like 99 times out of 100. when you get into the world of Gen AI, where it simply can decide it, you know, it's not doing it right, it's just getting it wrong, and no matter how much cajoling, we'll get it to do the thing that you just got it to do 10 minutes ago. And especially if you've started to weave that into your workflow, you're now doing things either in a fundamentally different way, or you're doing things that you couldn't do before. At some point, you're going to hit an immovable object when the model simply won't or can't do it, right? And therefore, you can't rely on me anymore, right? As a human, if I've bolted that into my workflow, because as a human, I'd problem solve it. But you've been in these situations as much as I have, where you're trying to ask it to do something relatively simple, and it just can't get its head around it. Mm-hmm. Just can't do it, and you end up doing it yourself, right? It's going to take less time for me to just do this myself. Now, what if you can't do that? And what if, you know, you've just wasted a whole morning of productive time trying to convince this thing to do something relatively simple, and now your time estimates are all blown? And there's always problems that arise. Humans aren't perfect, but we're pretty decent at managing teams and managing groups, managing our own time, and we can generally do build in tolerances for things going wrong, right? But they have the ability to go so astray when you're building using these things that, as confident as I am getting models to do things for me, I don't feel confident enough to say, no, I can guarantee you this is now only going to take me 12 hours, which would have taken me, you know, double that, triple that before, because I've got a model in the mix. No, I'm going to have to still say that's 36 hours. And if I'm lucky, I'll get it done in 12, right? And has that really taken us that far forward? You know what I mean?
As we go down this path of caveat after caveat, that I start to see the real problem coming out. You know, how do you talk someone through that and then still sound really positive about it? You know, this task I was doing, if I was going to do it myself, it would have taken me, I would say, half an hour. And I'm quite concentrated half an hour. You're dealing with figures, you're taking them out, you've got to do calculations. So you want to sort of be double checking those. It's really easy to transpose numbers, you know, all of that sort of thing. Could do a little bit fiddling, taking stuff out of HTML or PDF. So, you know, it's doing it in 40 seconds. I mean, that's a massive, massive time saving if it gets it right. Okay, maybe I'll check it. It takes 5 minutes, you know, but that's a, you know, 20 minute saving minimum. Do that three times in an hour and you've got yourself, you know, like 45 minutes back or something. So that's feeling pretty good. And then, well, it's not done it right. And so the first point, as you say, you've got that moment of, well, what do I do? Do I try and fix what it's done, or do I just walk away from it right now? And then you're into that unknown estimate around time sink. You know, if this is going to take me half an hour, just doing it on my own, I'm now 3 minutes in realizing it's wrong. Well, I could take that 3 minute and just dump it, right? No one's going to notice 3 minutes. Or I could start trying to figure out a better prompt and get it to do this. And maybe in 15 minutes, I'm still not getting the right answer. And when I'm in that 15 minute mark, well, now it's a problem, because now I'm thinking, oh, well, this really is half of my time. And then you're into the, yeah, bit of sunk cost fallacy. Well, I better carry on because I've been doing this for so long. And, you know, you want to be able to suss that out, you know, in minute three. You want to be able to look at it and go, oh, I know that this can be sorted if I just do these things. And to sell that to somebody that it's going to be really good, but sometimes it might be much worse and you'll end up, you know, going down this path. As you say, it's the reality of life. It's the reality we've all had with any type of system or even non-systems processes and things that we do. But as you say, is that any better than where you were before you started with this? And that doubt, I think, is one of the key problems. You know, I want to be positive and say to people, well, you're really missing out here, right? And I generally do say that. But at the same time, I feel very uncomfortable, like a snake oil salesman, by saying, oh yeah, it's definitely going to improve your life, no doubt, which is what I hear a lot of people saying. And it just makes me cringe because I know it's a bit of a sales pitch. Also know that it's not true. And it doesn't take more than an hour of working with these things to realize that there are better use cases and worse use cases. And at some point, I can't tell the difference between them, and I'm going to get sucked into a time waste.
Arbitrarily inappropriate, right, for some people. Am I better off because these models, at least from a productivity perspective? Absolutely, 100%. I am unequivocal about that. I am absolutely better off. Jane Bloggs across the road there going to be better off? I mean, toss a coin. I don't know, right? It might. It might help. It might not. And that's the issue, right? There's a level of uncertainty, even between two people who have productivity needs that are quite similar. And it's like saying, you know, look, here's some boots. You know, they're welly boots or whatever, walking boots. They're waterproof, right? Except if you've got, they only come in one size. And if you've got really small feet and legs, the water just comes in the top. So they're not waterproof, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm selling it to people without knowing their shoe size. You know what I mean? It's just like, I don't know. This is arbitrarily not going to work for you, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not even that simple. It's like, we sell these welly boots, but they come in arbitrary sizes, right? And some of them do have holes in them at the bottom, right? So if you buy these, a certain percentage of you will have dry feet. Right, but I can't tell you which ones of you are going to have dry feet, and therefore, if my shop sold these wellies and nothing else, I am going out of business, right? And that's exactly the problem we've got here, because the consumer proposition is boots with dry feet. I mean, there might be some extra bits around it, like, oh, do they look good or whatever, but ultimately the consumer proposition of welly boots is dry feet. Right, and the moment you say you might have dry feet, what you mean? My feet might get wet in certain circumstances. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I literally can't tell you whether these are going to keep your feet dry or not. But if they do keep your feet dry, you're going to have dry feet. Right? Who's going to buy that? Right? And that's the problem. Right?
Yeah.
It's just like that. That's not a consumer proposition. That's random. I'm better off just going to get some. Shopping bags and strapping them around my shoes. I mean, like, and that's the problem. But I've got welly boots and they've got no holes on them and they fit me fine. Well, they fit me fine, right? And they look okay. And that's my experience with Gen AI, is that I've got dry feet, right? But most other people got leaks. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And how you sort of replicate that across everyone else is the real trick. And I think this is what you're saying, isn't it, about a lot of the improvements won't come necessarily from the models themselves, but how they're put together and the larger process that they end up sitting in. So, you know, people talk about guardrails, so elements of a longer process where extra stages are put in, which check outputs from models and add extra bits in and do some extra bits here and there, which removes some of the unreliability and makes it more specific to the use case you have. You can definitely see companies going down that path. And as we've said before, yeah, that could be really good. If you're in a business where dry feet is essential, then starting with a product that's good 95% of the time is great. And if you're working on that extra 5%, and that 5% is worth a lot to your company and your customers, then you'd definitely do it. But you've got to
if we're keeping things dry, we're keeping all my timber dry, because I make things with wood. Yeah, I really need that. 95% though might be fine. But if what I'm storing is dairy foods and meats and stuff, right? 95%, no, fuck off. Right? I mean, that's a disaster. And that's the other problem, right? Like, your tolerances and mine are not the same. right? Actually, yours and mine probably are relatively similar, but mine and, you know, someone who works in a bank, right, are definitely not the same. Not because I'm somehow reckless. It's just I'm not dealing with people's bloody finances, right? And hopefully never will be.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, we talked about the personalized software side of it is if you take that into account, as in I've got these models and a setup, which is specific to me, I have my own tolerances, and that's all you're worried about, then you know, that's the mindset where these things work much better for you. Because, you know, as we said, you know, the one area you're not worried about and it's going wrong, we don't really care. Whereas someone else sees that and has a complete fit. And it's great. We'll go and, you know, hone your own model and process to work within your own tolerances. But from a company point of view, and that leads to this, you know, in this complete nightmare of, well, you know, every person doing that process does it differently. There's no commonality there. And, you know, companies don't work well under those circumstances. They work better under the opposite. Everyone does the same process. It looks the same.
Well, I think people misunderstand the function of a company, right? A business, because if you could make your welly boot company, right, and you can churn out tens of billions of these things and make squillions of dollars of money, right, on your own, then that's what you're going to do, right? A business is a stability creation machine, right? A business is something that creates scale and stability, right? It makes things repeatable. It makes things quality assured and consistent. The whole point about McDonald's is that you go into a McDonald's in Baghdad and you go into a McDonald's in St. Petersburg or in New York. If you order a Big Mac, you're supposed to get the same Big Mac to all intents and purposes, right? So what is McDonald's? It's a consistency creation machine, and that needs process. It needs stability. It needs a constancy of skill and supply and quality of product, right? And rank that quality where you like, right? You could think about McDonald's as being the lowest common denominator of food, or even the best thing that ever existed. But one way or the other, it sort of doesn't matter what the quality level is. It's the consistency that matters, right? And pretty much every business is like this. I don't see how you can even describe a business that requires a lack of consistency and an increase and maximization of chaos to work. It's antithetical. I'm not saying that businesses need stability. I'm saying that businesses exist to create it. A business and instability, they're synonymous. They're the same thing, right? And therefore, when you put this entity in the middle of a business that has a ceiling or a floor, I guess, a ceiling in the amount of stability that it can offer, that's problematic in every single business. And so you can then only apply it to the parts of your business where its level of consistency exists in a range that's acceptable.
Yes.
So back to storing timber versus storing food, right? You've got much higher tolerances of water if you're storing timber, right? And that's cool, right? So store it in a warehouse, but all that meat needs to be in a hermetically sealed fridge. Thank you very much. And therefore, you know, can anything that's not a hermetically sealed fridge cater for my needs in terms of storing my food? Well, arguably not, right? I mean, so the analogy falls apart at some point. But there are certain areas where this is never going to be appropriate. And so you take it at one point at a time, right? We've got 80% here, 80% there, 90% here across my business. But does all of that inconsistency, even when spread out across multiple different areas of the business, start to add up to a level of ambient inconsistency which is incompatible with the operations of any business, right? And then you just throw in things like procurement departments that exist to defend businesses from this type of shit, right? Gen AI, large language models, should not pass muster, right? That's not to say they have no value. I'm simply saying that businesses should resist them by their very nature. And I think this is where the biggest problem lies.
Yeah. It's very interesting, though, isn't it? Because as we've talked about before, you shouldn't worry too much about the details of the process, what's the end result. And, you know, the higher you fly away from a business for the 10,000-foot view, the more you can start to see, well, you know, there are a lot of inefficiencies here, but overall, you know, we're doing things and we're doing enough to get efficient out the end of the door. So each individual step doesn't necessarily have to be 100% perfect and could have much lower tolerances. And you could argue that, well, I'll slip out an LLM in there. It's pretty low, but it's better than what it was before. And, you know, you can add in processes around it to improve it. So why should you care that it might be inefficient in how it's doing it, as long as it's doing it with intolerance? And that's sort of an interesting thought. So, you know, the 10...
Well,
ten,
yes and no. But so the issue here, though, and I've really felt, because there are so many aspects of this buzzing around in my head right now, but if you think about this from the perspective, and this is where you started it, which is essentially selling this into people, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have a founded belief that some people, if not every person, would benefit to some degree in some part of their life by using a language model to improve productivity, right? That's a reasonably inarguable point of view. Right. But the problem is, it's not about what the reality is here. It's the sales pitch that's the problem. Right. Because we're back to my wellies. Right. The moment I explain to you that, I'm sorry, you may or may not have dry feet, you're going to be like, there's nothing for me here. Right. You're not going to go to me, well, yeah, but there are certain circumstances I don't need dry feet. So, yeah, sure, I'll buy some of your wellies, right? Because wellies don't look great. So what? I don't know. Maybe some people are stupid enough to go, well, okay, I'm still going to pay you the same amount of money for these wellies that may or may not work, right? There's a fundamental problem with basic sales and marketing here, in that it sort of doesn't matter whether it would work in some part of your business, if what you're saying on the outset that A, you don't know where it's going to work, and B, you don't know if it's going to work, right? I mean, you might as well just literally be selling snake oil. And there's no difference from an outside-in perspective, which is why so many of these conversations with people who don't know about this stuff ends the same way, because it absolutely bloody should end that way, right? I'm not saying that people shouldn't use these. I'm saying that they are being psychologically astute by walking away from them. And that's the problem that the entire industry has.
But should they walk away? That's the question. I mean,
yes, they should. I mean, it's basically risk mitigation. It's sensible and wise risk mitigation. And let's be clear about this. The people who construct these models, people like Sam Altman, are out there reinforcing this perspective that, you know, oh, they might work, they might not, right? They are broadcasting not only that these things are inconsistent, but they might kill you, right? And going, but yeah, you should all use them, right? I mean, this doesn't make any fucking sense, right? They're not even... It's so baffling that these people went to some of the best schools in the world to learn how to run businesses, and they don't even see the problem with their own rhetoric, right? It's nuts.
Well, I guess they're in the same position we are, which is I can see how useful these things are sometimes.
Well, they are trying to make them better, right? And so this is what we've not really got onto. And you mentioned some of the things that they're doing to make them better, right? And I'm using better in a very loose sense here. I know that all of this is arguable. Let's assume that at least their heart is in the right place and they're trying to make things better, right? Yeah. And so there are approaches for this, right? And so we went down the route where we had these monolithic models, GPT-3 onwards, that were very, very unreliable, but super, super exciting and quite impressive at the time. And then at one point we were being told, oh, you've got to do fine tuning. And now you're like, no, that's not fashionable anymore, like 2 weeks later, right? And then they'll be like, oh, everything's rag, right? Oh, yeah, it's going to solve your problems. Turns out rag's a ball ache and it's only very useful in a certain fairly narrow set of circumstances. And now they're like, right, so now you've got reasoning models, which can handle multi-step things, which is arguable not necessarily a better thing. It makes it better at certain tasks, but it doesn't help me if it still doesn't know the name of Elvis's second album, right? If it's getting something wrong that is canon, right? Yeah. And then you've got what GPT-5 is pretending to... I mean, GPT-5 for me is moving the goalposts on what defines a model, right? I'd probably think it's arguable for other reasoning models, but GPT-5 is the one that's most flagrantly, here's a bunch of models strapped together, right?
Yeah.
Like if I take a bunch of push bikes and strap them together, like, have I got a better bike?
Yeah.
Or like, basically, you've hired a little dude that stands there and tells me which push bike to use. It's more like your golf caddy, isn't it? GPT-5. Yeah, mate, have this 5-iron or whatever the shit it is. You know what I mean?
Well, it seems like it's that they've taken a feather out of people like, I mean, I'm going to say AMP, but there's any number of tools out there which take your prompts. Effectively analyze the prompt and then choose the model based on that. And that's what GPT-5 is trying to do, right? Yeah. It makes that decision.
And then it's not an innovation, right? It's not an innovation. And other companies have been doing this have been working on this problem for years. And then OpenAI just come out with GPT-5, which, let's be clear, was supposed to be the next generation, big step closer to, AGI, right? And, well, which is now not a term they use anymore. They've made up some new ones. If you don't like, if you can't meet that definition, you just create a different one that you are going to meet and make it up to suit your current agenda. But, like, it's not a new idea, right? And you can argue they're doing it better than anyone else because they understand their models, blah, blah, blah. Sure, whatever, right? It's still a bunch of models strapped together behind a bunch of models, which leads us straight into the fucking turtles all the way down conversation, right?
Yes.
Models selecting models and then checking the output of models, which need to have their output checked, which then need to have their output checked, blah, 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 ad infinitum, turtles. Yeah.
It is turtles, and I'm seeing this a lot. And there was on the Practical AI podcast, they had some guys on who have a company which are selling more the QA side of that. And they was basically said exactly that using models to QA other models is a legitimate approach. We talked about it, and you can see, I can see why that would be the case, because you're essentially using a prompt and potentially using some training on a model. Well, I don't know if you train it as such, but you definitely have a prompt where you're saying, well, the output you're expecting from this model has got to have these things about it. And we spoke about rubrics and that sort of thing, a specific set of instructions that and specifications that need to be met in order for an answer to be anywhere approaching correct or optimal, whatever sort of.
So I have to ask a question here, right? Mm. So if you've got a model that's got a rubric, right? Work with me on this one, right? This is good. You're going to like this. So you got... I don't even need to tell the joke because it's funny enough for me. You'll have to guess it. You've got a model that's got a rubric, and then you've got a model that's testing that model that also needs a rubric. Yep. If then to test that model, you've got another model to test that one that has a rubric. Do you have a rubrics cube?
You would have had me, except for you gave me a signpost there.
I never said I was good at telling jokes, and yes. I did just make that one up on the spot, right? There's been some Rubik's Cube pun in there that I thought I knew I could find it. I found my way through it. You know, I'm particularly pleased with that one, even if my delivery was something to be desired.
You read the punchline before you got to the end. Very good. So Danny is around rubric cubed. So and then some more. And it's these sort of leading on from that a little bit. So the kind of idea of that they're creating new ways to think how to deal with them. You know, I suppose a little bit like, you know, enterprise resource software of the past, you know, no, don't try and adapt the tool to your business, adapt your business to the tool, because that's going to be the most efficient way of doing it. And I'm wondering if there's some of the same things here, which is, well, look, these models and how they work isn't going to change massively. So rather than waiting for them to change and to fix it, which might mean for some people, well, they're never going to step into it. Are there other ways that we can view it so that, rubric cubed. So you've got another more does that. But at the end of that, actually, we kind of got what we wanted, even though it might not be how a human looks at it. And that makes me think of, you know, the classic with all of this of, in terms of jobs is, you know, when you get a new technology come along, often you get a whole bunch of new jobs. And already we have, you know, prompt engineer. And I'm wondering if there's more stuff here. And you mentioned, you know, we mentioned about managing these things like employees. Are there these new skills we're going to need that you would use to, you know, get the best results you can out of these things? But there, you're doing things which you just don't need to do now because you don't have a tool which responds in this way.
I've got a fundamental problem with this idea of the rubrics cubed, of this model upon model upon model. I do agree that having models check the homework of other models is valid, in fact necessary. I'm good with that. But when we start to get back into the realms of businesses as consistency machines, they're not always efficient, and they do often have needless complexity. But most of that process existed to try and tame some level of unpredictability and complexity within the business. But so if what you're saying to me is that some part of this business will be improved by having a model upon a model upon a model upon a model, all of which are going to be by definition flawed because they are probabilistic language models, what you've done is you've taken one type of complexity, the type of complexity, I might add, that you can hire and fire and discipline and train, right? And replaced it with something that might actually be more arbitrarily difficult and unpredictable. So all the way through that, you've got the possibility of different, harder to spot and harder to account for types of problem that come from the very complexity of the machine and that it is by its nature stochastic. And if you ever listen, it came up again recently that there is some, I heard this on Tim Harford on, what's his podcast? Cautionary Tales, right? But it's a known concept. He talks about it a lot in terms of things like plane crashes. It's something like the Swiss cheese theory. There is a particular thinker or scientist associated with it. I'd need to look it up. But what this talks about is when problems happen, it's not because some one thing went wrong, i.e. the brake cable snapped and therefore I couldn't brake and I, you know, drove into the wall. It's usually an unfortunate alignment of edge case issues. And the point here is that if you've got a wheel of Swiss cheese and you're taking random slices from it and stacking them on top of each other, most of the holes are going to miss other holes, right? But over time, or by creating lots of different stacks of these, eventually you're going to get a configuration where the holes all line up, right?
Yeah.
At which point, that's when the plane crash happens, right?
Yeah.
That this bolt wasn't tied up properly, wasn't done up properly. This storm happened. This particular pilot happened to be on, and he overextended his shift, and so on. And then these seven things, when you add them up, made that plane crash inevitable, right? And so, okay, so if what we're talking about is, the Swiss cheese holes lined up and our production went down for a day of our Swiss cheese, right? The machine broke and we had to fix it. We lost a bit of productivity. Fine, we're all good. But people will die in certain circumstances when the Swiss cheese is wrong. Business will go out of business, right? And so by putting, a set of technologies that are by definition have holes in random parts of it, right? That will occur to a probabilistic degree. The opportunities for Swiss cheese holes to align, it feels to me, is increased. And this is the worry that I have. I think that this isn't just a problem of stochasticity, it's a problem of complexity. And yeah. I think that's when the problem, and these are going to be hard to spot, hard to predict. Every problem that arises like this is going to be a black swan. And my worry is that we're going to be deluged by black swans.
Yeah. And the complexity for me is what does it there, because it just makes me think of complex software, right? You run more and more of your business on software, all seems to be going fine. Then after 3 years, there's this catastrophic failure. And no one saw it coming. And part of the reason you don't see it coming is, one, because it's complex, and two, because it's fairly obscured. You've got millions of lines of code and someone checked them at some point, but did they check it against this new bit? Well, no. We did some tests which tested the overall output with the data we had at the time and the inputs we knew. But of course, things change. You get new sorts of inputs. The longer you've got data coming in, the more edge cases you get over time. Because edge case is going to be a low percentage, but the more stuff you get in, eventually you're going to get that route through. And I think, again, here, like you say, when you've got turtles all the way down, the models checking models checking models, and doing fairly mundane checking, here's a list of 2,000 lines. Can you check that each one's formed in this way? Well, no human's going to do that particularly well. And yes, the model is better, but there's still a problem coming out of it, and no one's looking at it. And so you layer these things on, it becomes obscured, no one's checking it, and generally it starts to fall apart and you see those holes lining up. Of course, the flip side is that's all about risk. And, and sometimes you have to take the risk to get the benefit.
Yeah, well, look, you sell subprime mortgages to people who can't, in any sense, afford the mortgage that you've sold them, and then you package up that risk and you sell it to someone else who repackages the risk and sells it to someone else. I mean this isn't a victimless crime, right? For the business environment to function, for the financial markets to function, there needs to be a level of stability. And I'm sorry, large language models are chaos generating machines, and they are at least inconsistency generating machines. And we haven't even got to the point, you know, about the models like they that happened with GPT-5, where they pulled the plug on GPT-4, I guess it was. And people lost their bloody minds because these things aren't interchangeable, right? That Claude Opus and GPT-5, whatever the top level version of that is called, are not interchangeable, even if you could argue that they do the same thing. They don't do it in the same way. GPT-4.0 and GPT-4.1 are not the same thing. They don't behave the same way. They don't do things in the same way. And so we've got this upgrade path that is, which is a breaking change every single time, right? So how does a business account for that when we have the situation where, you know, Red Hat exists because Linux can be arbitrarily updated and businesses need stability, right? So we have products like Red Hat Linux that are a wraparound for something that's inherently less stable to ensure stability for businesses, right? And so, yes, of course, we're going to see businesses that pop up that are the Red Hat of Gen AI, but like it doesn't just doesn't negate the fundamental problem. I mean, it's back to the core thesis of this particular episode, which I actually don't think we've covered, right? Which is, you know, what if they don't get any better, right? What if we are at peak model and, you know, what if we can what if we can at least agree that there is a concept of better, put on the back burner that we can't really define that, right? But, you know, we are where we are, yet the world keeps changing, right? So GPT-5 does not know that Angela Rayner is no longer Deputy Prime Minister of the UK, right? Therefore, there has to be a new version of it that does, right? And has that had to be retrained on the internet yet again, burning a bunch of bloody forests down to do so, using all the water in California, right? To have that knowledge, right? And to be able to extrapolate on that knowledge. And therefore, even if GPT-X going forward is only asymptotically better, like we're in diminishing returns that we're in the hundredths of a percentage point in terms of how accurate it is by any given measure, it still has to be updated, right, to reflect the world as it exists at any point in time. And that's going to change the model. And that means the next time you type in your prompt to GPT-5.9, right, that it might give you a fundamentally different result on exactly the same query, because when you retrain a model, all the weights change, all of them, right?
Yeah.
And so even if they do everything in their power to keep everything equal, like OpenAI say GPT-5 or whatever, GPT-6 is the last model we're ever going to produce from the perspective of how we approach making models. Every single model from here on will be trained in exactly the same way. You've still put new information in it, right? All of the weights in that model have still got to be changed, which means that the model consistency still will not be there. It will be better, but it will still produce different results, which means you need a mountain of QA around everything, or you need to take GPT-6.2, make that the model that you're going to use and never look at a different model again, and handle the fact that you need facts from your model in a different way by,
yeah,
not from what the model knows, but from what it does. So essentially saying, instead of just tell me about Elvis, you say no, or tell me about Angela Rayner, right? Don't tell me what you know about Angela Rayner. Go and look it up on bloody Wikipedia, right? And so how far have we come? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, and that's the weird thing. Like you say, you know, the reason you would, or one of the reasons you use these things because they are using data and acting like a human. And so you want them to be updated with new data. And that's also, as you point out, the very problem that then creates that they're inconsistent and therefore anything you do tomorrow is not the same as what you did today. So there's a real paradox there.
It doesn't solve the problem. If your thesis is the core problem here is accuracy and stability and reliability, reproducibility, then the answer is simply that is not going to improve much, right? I think that's a done deal. It doesn't mean to say that, like GPT-5, you can't wrap it in things that account for that.
Yeah.
I don't think it accounts for that. I don't think that having a model with the capability to interrogate the internet, but let's be clear, I don't need a model for that. I have an agent to interrogate the internet for me, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I can have that now, right, with anything, right back to, in fact, I've got a local Llama model running on my 8 gig VRAM GPU that does a perfectly serviceable job. And this is a model that was trained in 2024 or something that can just go and find stuff out for me off the internet, right? I can do that. No problem at all. I don't need OpenAI, right?
Yeah.
But it's not the same. It's not the same because it over time, that model drift, as it gets older and older and older, the types of reasoning that it can do, I say reasoning in quotes, is become less and less relevant and valuable because it's missing whole tranches of context, right? And these things rely on context to be able to make viable predictions about what the next word should be, right? So if all you need it to do is writing flat prose, then fine, right? If all it's got to do is write advertising copy, you're probably good. But if what you need to do is to help you because you're a journalist and you need to research or you want it to do anything creative or, you know, seemingly creative or to aid you be creative, it's going to get less and less good. It's just going to be like a radio, you know, that's just going to feel more and more out of date, right?
Yeah, and that's interesting because it just, as you run through there, I mean, you're essentially just pulling out different elements of, isolating elements from the main model. So, you know, give them a tool to go to the internet. Don't ask them for information, you know, give them a tool if they need to look at anything more than or more recent than 2 years old, you know, they're really good at general language and that probably doesn't need to be updated every week. So, you know, give them a tool if you need him to use the latest teenage slang or whatever. And if you can get a layer so it consistently uses tools at the right moment, then you are going to, you're essentially isolating out bits that you don't need and isolating the bits which are changed so you can get that consistency. And again, I can see companies definitely doing that, so you get the benefits of the a small part of the large language model, which is kind of a bit ironic. But
well, exactly. And do we need the? I mean, all language models are going to be large. I mean, reality is they have to be to be able to service the vastly different types of conversation you might have with it. Yeah, right. One of the first things I wrote down when we started talking here was knows in quotes versus does. And if I think about where the most recent gains have been, and really if we're talking about where it's improved my existence to the maximum is what the models are capable of doing. And it seems a lot of the effort that's being put in now, particularly around the reasoning models, is improving what they do rather than worrying too much about what they know, right?
Yeah.
And I think that points a direction, right, to where these things are going. And there's a degree to which it's probably not going to get any better at writing English or writing code or writing, or creating any set of strings. but it can get better at wielding those strings, right? And so, if what I am is a pharmaceutical, and you and me have worked in pharmaceuticals, we know that you can sit in a meeting in a pharmaceutical company in the UK where everyone is talking English, and knowing full well that every single word that has been said in this meeting was said in English, and you didn't understand any word, like apart from the ands and the ifs and the ofs and stuff, right? Pharmaceuticals have a patois, right? And it's really healthcare and indeed science, and pick your scientific discipline, is the same, right?
Yeah.
So what I need is a model that can interact using that patois. I don't need to understand when Elvis Presley was born, right?
Yeah.
I don't need to understand or describe to me the flag of Latvia, right? I just don't need this shit, right? What the model I need needs to understand the full breadth of the English language, because that's what I'm going to use, and it really needs to understand or know how to wield pharmaceutical or healthcare patois, right?
But yeah.
that's going to be a very specialized model at that point. And I think that's where this is all going, right?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And that's where I think the usefulness is going to be. So even if those models don't get better from here on out, there's still a fair bit to be done to make what we've got work more how we want them to.
Yeah, so I think the question is, I can't see it. If all we're talking about is language models, LLMs, using the transformer architecture, because we are, right? What I'm not saying is there is no possibility of building a different type of AI that will solve all of these problems. I don't see it. I don't know what that is. I don't think anyone's talking about it, but absolutely no question, I'm sure something could be done here. But if what we're doing is using the transformer architecture to build large language models, I can't see that we're not in well down the road in diminishing return territory. And you can, and the reason I say that is because the companies that are having tens of hundreds of billions of dollars pumped into them and have recruited all the best minds in this area in the world are not working on solving the problems that we've discussed. They're working on making these things better at doing things. And that says to me, we're in diminishing returns territory with the nature of the models themselves. I don't think it's controversial to call that fact, right? So the core thesis of this is, what if this is as good as it gets? Well, I'm telling you, it is, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean to say that there's not going to be some pretty big changes in terms of what that means, in terms of now we built the internal combustion engine, right? That didn't just give us cars, it gave us vans, it gave us it gave us planes, it gave us all sorts of things, right? But we're still just burning oil to create motion, right? And so it got better, but ultimately we're in diminishing returns in that territory as well, right? So I'm not saying that we haven't still got aeroplanes and spaceships to come, but if this is the foundation, you know, it's not, there's not a lot left in this. And it just comes back down to how you wield it, right? And what are those killer use cases that are really going to make a difference? And will we be using like highly specialized models to do that? I would say yes.
So we're just waiting for the next architecture breakthrough, which takes us down a different path.
Well, the thing is, though, the path has to be so different, right? Because if there was an obvious fork along the way that was going to solve these problems, that would have been taken, right?
Yeah. Yes.
I think the people that understand these things the most will all say the same thing, is that the fundamental problems with LLMs are not surmountable using LLMs, right?
Yeah.
It's just not. It's just not a thing. So, yeah, I mean, but the thing is, I would love it if anyone turned up and says, look, I've scratched this out on the back of a beer mat. Here's the answer to the problem using a completely different approach. If anyone was saying that, that was getting any level of publicity whatsoever, you know, I'm all ears, but yeah. I'm not hearing it.
No, not yet. Anyway,
that's because they're all having to fucking burn money. You know, they're all having, they all got sucked into OpenAI, trying to force another 0.1% of supposed value out of the existing paradigm. Until the whole thing comes crashing down, because it was all a big house of cards anyway, and then we have the next massive financial crash, which will either happen in 4 minutes' time or in 4 years' time or something, but who the hell knows? Just like the language models, it's arbitrarily near or far away.
Yeah, it's arbitrarily good or bad. Well, yes. And I think that we covered a fair amount there, so pretty cool a halt to it there.
Well, today, I mean, I feel like, again, we just scratched the very surface of the tip of the iceberg. I think the final piece here isn't really a piece at all, which we could decide to do next, which is my everything via the terminal mandate.
Yeah.
Which I think, to a degree, does tie some of these conversations together, so I think it's worth doing. Because I think I'm certainly not the only one doing this, but philosophically it looks regressive, but I would argue it's the exact opposite. So I think we should do that, whether we do that next or not. I guess we'll see where our noses take us, or yes, whether or not we get the apocalypse kicks in the meantime, and we must finish every episode off with an apocalypse. So there you go. This shit ain't getting better. Apocalypse is this one.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to that. It'd be good to get some practical tips.
Yeah. See ya.
See ya.
The confusion matrix. Confusion.